Thank you, David, for putting all this together. I enjoyed myself immensely yesterday. I must also say that it would be an indictment of academics if they were not interested in the specific practices of the thing. How can you speculate about the larger picture if you don't have the down-on-the-ground view? And in international relations, which is where I sort of hang out, there is a so-called practice turn, where the idea is you should start with actually this should be fairly obvious, but we should start with knowing the stuff, and then we should do the theorizing. Unfortunately, that has not always been the case. People have started with an idea of the state system and then somehow extrapolated, which to my mind makes no sense. So we're all in your debt for putting this together, and it's always nice to have a meeting of academics and practitioners, particularly when the academics know what the heck they are actually hearing. And I think we will today. Rosa Balfour is our first speaker, and I have had the pleasure of hearing her before, so I'm looking forward to this. You are senior policy analyst at the European Policy Center, basically sort of running the whole thing, I think, more or less. I think we'll just hand it over to you.
Thank you very much, Ivor. First thing I need to say is that I've been carrying out research together with my colleague Kristi Reich from the Finnish Institute of International Affairs, looking at whether and how the External Action Service has changed national diplomacies. And we've been doing this with a network of researchers based in 15 member states. The papers will be coming out early next year. Of course, I'm receiving first drafts of papers, so I'm going to share with you some reflections on the basis of the initial findings from this research project. Second methodological point, I've been following the External Action Service at least since its birth, if not perhaps even earlier. And I think there's one thing we need to be aware of, and that is things are changing, and they change quite quickly. So if you're interviewing people today, they're going to say things which are probably quite different to what they might have said a year ago or even 6 months ago. So I think for academics, the time frame actually needs to be quite important. I think yesterday we mentioned the impact of the first year of the External Action Service on the performance, on the perceptions of the External Action Service. I think that's a very valid point. David gave me a very nice title, Cooperation or Rivalry Between the External Action Service and the Member States, and I have a short answer to this. At the moment, it's neither. It's neither cooperation nor rivalry. However, I would also say that they are bound to cooperate. And I would add, and that's a think tank in me, that there is potential for much more. And the real risk is that that potential is not fulfilled. I think if I were to summarize the relationship between the External Action Service and the national foreign affairs ministries, and of course I'm making a sweeping generalization here, I would use this metaphor, which is not a very elegant metaphor, but I can't think of another one, and that is they're like dogs which are smelling each other. There has not been a sort of leap forward in Europeanization patterns, nor has there been a backlash or a step backwards, with one notable exception. I think the fact that there hasn't been a step backwards is actually quite important, because there's a lot of talk about renationalization of foreign policy. We don't actually see, or at least I haven't actually seen, evidence of this at this level. So I think it's actually quite an important conclusion. The creation of the External Action Service has not caused major changes in the structures of national foreign ministries, but also in terms of policy substance. We have generally seen an attitude of wait and see. Let's see whether the External Action Service can prove its added value. Let's see whether the External Action Service can actually improve the foreign policy-making situation compared to before the Lisbon Treaty. And this is very much the attitude of the member states. It also is worth noting that the member states were unprepared for the implications of the Lisbon Treaty. There was no strategy towards the External Action Service that was developed, except for one particular issue, and that is an overwhelmingly strong focus on staffing. The idea of putting in the best people, which is something that Catherine Ashton wanted, the best and the brightest. But beyond staffing, there hasn't actually been a strategy on part of the member states in terms of structures, in terms of internal restructuring. And this is particularly noteworthy in a context of cuts. Most, not all, but most of the foreign affairs ministries have been undergoing cuts and rationalizing their internal departments as a consequence of these cuts. None of them have done so in light of the existence of the External Action Service or in preparation for the creation of the External Action Service. So there has no member state has been seizing the opportunity, shall we say, for rationalizing, for making cost-effective decisions in light of the External Action Service creation. And therefore, we see a continuity in patterns of interaction between the EU and member states, so patterns of Europeanization or patterns of trying to upload national preferences to the European level. These patterns haven't seen a fundamental change. As I also said, there has not been a major backlash, with one notable exception, of course, and that is the representation of the EU in international organizations, where the situation is actually pre-Lisbon Treaty. This is something that we mentioned yesterday, and perhaps we can talk more about. So where are we? What do the member states expect from the External Action Service? There is a very strong demand for coordination. It is really the big expectation. And I have to say, there is, even in the most skeptical countries, there is relative satisfaction with the degree of coordination, with the work of the Political and Security Committee, with the work of the working groups. And in particular, there is a fairly good degree of satisfaction with the ways in which the delegations have changed. And the coordination, the role given to the heads of mission to coordinate the national ambassadors on the ground, that transition has actually occurred quite smoothly. There's also a fair amount of satisfaction with performance and sort of policy substance in certain areas. The Balkans, Syria, Iran, Sahel, they're all areas that are mentioned by the member states and by officials in the External Action Service as areas where work has proceeded fairly smoothly. There are mixed views on political reporting, which I think is actually quite an important aspect, which could have an impact, a longer-term impact on the role of the External Action Service. And the mixed impressions depend very much on whether the reporting is done on areas of which the member state does not have much knowledge or whether it is the reporting. So it depends very much on the context. So I'm going to refrain from making generalizations here. It depends on which member state, which geographical area we are talking about. But information sharing is one way. The External Action Service is sharing information with the member states. The opposite is quite simply not happening. And the External Action Service does not actually, people in the External Action Service do not appear to expect this to happen either. There also are no plans for burden sharing between the member states and the External Action Service, which is a shame because this is an area where perhaps some innovative practices could be found. And as I said, there are no plans for some joint thinking on rationalizing resources. And again, this could have, not in a very short period of time, it could have a huge impact on the External Action Service, simply because no additional resources are being given to this new body. Where there is interest in the member states, and that is in very pragmatic solutions regarding co-location, the possibility of having laptop diplomats. Obviously, member states which do not have missions in abroad are very interested in receiving the reports from the EU delegation. So it's very much focused on those areas where the member states are less strong. And, of course, this is applicable mostly to the smaller member states rather than to the larger member states, which have a broader and stronger network of delegations abroad. So the key word really is complementarity. The member states do not want the External Action Service to step on their toes, and the External Action Service spends a lot of time trying to demonstrate that it will not interfere. So the level of cooperation is actually limited by the notion of complementarity. Why is this? I will provide a few answers, but they don't necessarily apply to all member states. There are a lot of differences, and we need to be aware of that. But there are very low levels of trust. And I have to say, perhaps naively, I was expecting more trust, because the people are the same. It's former Commission RELEX people and former Council people who were working with the member states and with their diplomacies in the past. So why not transfer that trust to the External Action Service? This has quite simply not happened. I think also there are some perhaps unintended or unforeseen consequences of the end of the rotating presidency beyond the role, the diminished role of the foreign ministers. There is a fear of marginalisation, which is also reflected in the attitudes of the diplomats. And there is some sense of identity, which is us being in the member states and them being in Brussels. The rotating presidency, in a way, functioned also as a transmission belt for the pet projects that individual member states might want to carry out. They felt that through the rotating presidency, there was greater access to the center. Now there is an idea which is shared by many member states, is they have insufficient access to the External Action Service and are insufficiently able to influence the processes there. And this is largely because there is a very widespread suspicion of the role of the big three, Britain, France, and Germany, playing an overly important role in influencing the service, the decisions made there, and also having too much access to the service itself, whereas the smaller member states are less represented. I would actually say that if you look at the patterns of staffing patterns, I think I would actually say this fear is overly strong. Even the small member states are actually quite well represented in the External Action Service with respect to their size. Partly as a consequence of this, the External Action Service has been very humble in relations with the foreign affairs ministries and with member states. The emphasis has been very much on coordination, on consensus building. Very few initiatives have come from the center of this network. But there is another consequence that perhaps hasn't been thought through sufficiently, and that is on the ownership principle of the member states. The whole trick of the External Action Service was to ensure that the member states were on board. But if the member states are not making initiatives, if they're not using the service to try and foster a discussion about what kind of policy initiatives are to be taken, they are going to lose ownership. So therefore, in that case, the risk is, so whereas now we have a situation where the External Action Service is closer to a secretariat, if the member states lose or do not work on their ownership of the service, the risk is that the External Action Service will become a weak 28th foreign ministry. So the situation in which the External Action Service is one of entrapment. There's no push for leadership coming from within, but there's no push for leadership coming from outside. And of course, how this might evolve will depend very much on the politics at the EU level, which go beyond the politics of foreign policy. We have initiatives in the foreign policy field coming from certain member states, such as Sweden and Poland, but of course, that kind of leadership does not overlap with leadership in political and economic affairs. So there's a real risk that foreign policy in the future will be bereft of, or even of today, will be bereft of leadership. Final point on the idea that I do think the External Action Service and the member states are bound to cooperate. It is rather for a sort of negative reason, and that is because of the politics of scale. Size matters, and you know the sort of general decline trend will force the member states to work together with the External Action Service. But the more opportunities are missed, the higher the risk that the External Action Service, rather than being an innovative actor for the global challenges of today, will be tomorrow an actor capable of dealing with things of today. But tomorrow the world might have changed. So I think there really is a risk of these opportunities being missed. Thank you very much. Oops.
Thank you so much, Rosa. Hugo Schulte, you have actually asked if you could introduce yourself, and I see no reason why I should not, so please.
Thank you. Good morning, everyone. And thanks very much for the invitation to come here today. I hope I can add to... Is this still working? I hope I can add to what you have already heard, and including from speakers yesterday. I'm fairly new to this game. I've been in my current job for 3 months. I was in Paris before that, doing economic work and justice and home affairs, so not this side of EU work. I'm quite struck with... I mean, it's a very interesting situation we're in with a very new organization, the EEAS, that has not been around even for 2 years yet. And I think one has to bear that in mind in commenting on it. 2 years into any large international organization is pretty soon. Foreign ministries, diplomatic services, external action services are extraordinarily complex organizations with a very diffuse leadership, and I'm speaking from experience of over 20 years in the Foreign Office. They're complex and they're hard to lead, and they're hard to focus. In that context, I think the EEAS has had a strong start, and that is the view of my ministers in the Foreign Office as well. You can look at the evidence they've given in Parliament, and it's pretty clear that there are a number of areas where we feel the EEAS has done an excellent job. I think you probably heard from Angus Lapsley yesterday some of those areas, so I won't go in depth into those, but if we want to look at this from the point of view of making a real difference to the outcomes of European diplomacy, I think it's fair to say that there are a number of areas where the British government, are extremely pleased to see the progress that's been made, and in a sense we are demandeurs for more. Let me give you some examples of the positive. Briefly, we can talk about those in more detail if you like. And then one or two examples of where we would like to see more done. I'm sure the example of Iran has been mentioned already in this conference. I do think it is an extremely strong success story for the High Representative and for the EEAS. The ability of the EEAS to work in different groupings to take forward quite a complex and demanding diplomatic strategy is remarkable. It works well within the E3. It works well between articulating between the E3 and the 27 member states. It works well in terms of representing the E3+3 in the negotiations with Iran, with the UN Security Council mandate. And it's actually quite remarkable that the High Representative chairs the E3+3 negotiations with Iran. Those are things which are valuable, and I don't think that role is something that one of the E3 member states, for example, could have taken on. It's something that requires a different angle, if you like, and that is one where the EAS has brought real value added. I should add one further point, which is the work they do in explaining the policy of the E3 and the E3+3 more widely with international actors who might be more skeptical if they were to hear that explanation exclusively coming from the three member states in question. So that's one area I think we can genuinely say we're very pleased with. And their role on sanctions, on developing sanctions on Iran, is also important. So the other track of the Iranian diplomatic effort. They have been very helpful in explaining to member states how to build a sanctions package, what the practical effects will be, working closely with the Commission on that, and communicating with third countries about what we're doing in the sanctions field. This requires an awful lot of work behind the scenes, and the EEAS has been absolutely key in putting together sanctions packages, which are probably the most the toughest sanction packages yet devised. But I suppose Iran is a slightly exceptional case because we're not working in the usual format, in the format that was foreseen when the Lisbon Treaty was negotiated. But there are other areas too, in the Middle East. I think the role of the EU has increased. I think in developing a strategy towards the Arab Spring countries, of course, there was a considerable debate in Brussels about how to develop that strategy, what should go in, what level of conditionality, what were our objectives, how do we achieve them, trade versus aid and all those things. That is quite natural, and I think that will remain a way of doing business in Brussels, so long as member states have their own foreign policies. They are going to have their own positions that they will want to work through in Brussels. But nonetheless, I think the EU developed a robust strategy, which is now implementing. And I think the role of the EAS, working alongside the other EU institutions, was key in doing that. And there are other areas too. There's the Balkans. I mean, Robert Cooper was here yesterday. He has played a very important role in helping to build stability and move things in the right direction in that region. So there are a number of areas where we feel that a lot has been achieved. I don't think in achieving that I would characterize the process as being one of rivalry between member states and the EAS. And not really exactly rivalry between the member states themselves. There are rival views, but in a sense it's not a zero-sum game between member states. We just happen to have different historical perspectives, different democratic demands on us, and so on, which mean that we come at things from a different economic interest, which means we come at things from a rather different angle. But I don't sense it's a rivalry as such. I think it's a robust debate about what the best approach is. We're not saying, and this won't surprise you, I guess, that the EAS is perfect. Nor is the EAS saying that, by the way, either. Many of you will have seen Cathy Ashton's letter at the end of last year giving a kind of first report on how the EAS was developing, and we felt, we recognized a lot of our own analysis there. We felt that there were things there that, we reflected our own experience. For example, we too would like to see more policy initiative coming from the EAS. Let me give you an example. If you look at the EU strategic relationships with major powers, I don't think, we certainly don't think that we have really quite gone as far as we should in developing an EU strategy towards the major powers. If we look at China, for example, it's right that many of our objectives are economic, trade, market access objectives. That's quite right. But we do need to move beyond a shopping list that represents every member state's individual interests, which means you have a list that's too long, really, to make a great deal of progress on, to something that is prioritized, reflecting kind of the EU's greatest kind of economic interest overall. You know, a priority list which has, well, I don't know what the actual number is, but let's say a priority list with 20 or 30 priorities on it is not a priority list. We need a process, and I think to achieve it, you need the EAS working with the Commission to help us. You need a process that boils it down to a handful of top priorities worked out with a strategy to deliver those. So that's the kind of area where we think the EAS can do more and can add more value. In terms of how it works, I might just come back on one or two of the things you say. I agree with you on the point about policy proposals then. We also think that delegations, EU delegations overseas, we would like to see them, if you like, participate more in the policy creation process, perhaps reflecting our own processes in the Foreign Office, where posts are absolutely key to developing policy proposals, and it's we feel that more account could be taken of what delegations have in terms of local knowledge and experience in developing proposals to be tabled in Brussels. And talking to colleagues within who are working in the EAS, there are clearly some issues that still need further work, like the flow of information should be expanded. Again, maybe this reflects a bit the Foreign Office culture, where there is too much information on one level, but at least it means that all posts with an interest on a particular issue will see all the reports on that issue. It's not so much hub and spoke, but many overlapping networks, if you like, the way the information is shared. There is an issue of security of information in the EAS and in the institutions more broadly, which is not unconnected to the way information flows. And there's also a very important issue that Baroness Ashton raised in her letter, and that is the issue of cooperation, or working between the EU institutions, the Commission, and the EAS. We feel there's further to go in delivering what was in both the treaty and in the decision, which was, and I quote, that the EAS shall support and work in cooperation with the diplomatic services of member states, fine, as well as with the General Secretariat of the Council and services of the Commission, in order to ensure consistency between the different areas of the Union's external action and between those areas and its other policies. And we would like to see, more on that front. We think that cooperation, if you like, integration between the Commission and the EAS needs to go further. And we, it's not easy. I realise that, but there are ways in which the delegations work as well, which are affected by this. So it's not just the coordination of external action, but it's also within the delegation, different chains of reporting and different chains of management of budgetary resources and so on that we feel need to be resolved. So that is my kind of summary of where we are on this. Some good progress more to do, I suppose, which is not surprising 22 months into a large and complex new organization. Thanks.
Thank you so much. I think so much progress, some progress and more to do could sum up most lives, or at least most successful lives. And there is a sense in which the sniffing out metaphor and the way we discuss this, when we focus on a specific relationship between two kinds of organizations, it all seems so particular and special and sui generis and I don't know what. But the basic problems here seem to me seem to be rather general. You mentioned that the priority list of 20-30 priorities is not a priority list. We know why it is so hard to boil them down. It is because every single part of the organization wants its say and it wants its stuff to be on top of the priority list. And the lazy leader or the lazy politician would simply stop right there and not do the hard work of boiling it down. And this is because where you stand, as Graham Allison once said, depends on where you sit. And in this country, I think Thomas A. Becket has become sort of shorthand for this kind of problematique. And it should therefore not necessarily surprise us that people, although it's the same people and they've been working together before, take up different standpoints when they work in different organizations. And my intervention, I will simply make one point in terms of response, which is that this seems to be a problem which is haunting diplomacy overall now, also bilateral diplomacy. When I look at the continuing emergence of bilateral diplomacy and its characteristics, what I see is a proliferation of agency in the sense that, well, let me give you two concrete examples. European foreign ministries are in a continuous tug-of-war with the prime minister's offices, and the people who are going over and working in the international departments in the prime minister's offices usually come from the foreign ministries. And you see exactly the same kind of logic. Once they leave the MFA and start working at the PMO, their priorities change. Then they come back and their priorities change back. This is just, I think, part of a human condition. Right? Add to that the second thing, which is that ministries of foreign affairs throughout Europe and the West, and increasingly also in other parts of the globe, work through a number of different kinds of organizations. And this they have always done in the sense that they have mustered their society's organizations and used them in the field. When it comes to development work or when it comes to, I've researched the landmines issue, for example, where the idea was that the MFA sat back there and it was not two Irish women and an unlikely constellation of ex-military and idealists who were actually doing the landmines work. It was certain states who were orchestrating this from the back row. And the same thing seems to be going on in peace and reconciliation work, and it goes on in the use of consultancies throughout the world. The key thing that has happened, I think, over the last 10 to 20 years is that states have stopped exclusively using their own society's organizations and simply use what is available internationally. So when Norway, I use the country I know best as an example, when Norway does its peace and reconciliation work, it does not only use the Norwegian societal organizations' presence, they will shop around in Geneva for different kinds of organizations. And the relevance to this here is that there is somehow an implied baseline for the discussion of the relationship between the EEAS and the membership state and the member states, which is that you have these pristine organizations which work only with their with citizens from their own states and only sort of have interfaces with societal organizations in that particular state. But this seems to be a baseline which is dissolving. There seems to be an ecstasy of different kinds of organizations going on all over the place. And if that is a frame of comparison, then the specific case under discussion seems less special and more a symptom of and a constitutive part of a wider globalizing thrust in diplomacy, I think. Should we open up for debate? We have about 20 to 25 minutes. Sir, do we have a microphone? Right there. Mm-hmm. Take this one. Oh, no. Okay. No batteries. Could you, maybe you could try by sort of viva voce, huh?
Does seem to me that by defending the EEAS, by saying what its achievements are, you and others, people who were testifying to the House of Lords subcommittee the other day, are being very defensive, and even worse, you're being implausible. Because the truth is, and Robert admitted it, that all of the achievements that you've listed and that other people list are all things that could have happened and would have happened perfectly well under the old regime. Javier Solana, take Iran as an example. Javier Solana led that very well. It actually started without EU involvement at all, as you know. But once the EU was involved, Javier Solana led it, long before the present dispensation. Javier Solana, Chris Patten before him, solved a lot of Balkan problems without an EEAS. That's not to say there shouldn't be an EEAS, but I think you should start from a different defense. And I suggest to you that the defense is what Robert said yesterday. Come on, what do you expect in 18 months? We're only just setting up point A. B, what the EAS does is all the things that the Commission delegations used to do. And they're very important. The administration of a huge aid program, running trade negotiations, all sorts of other things that are key to EU's external relations and policies. And the EAS is doing all the things that successive presidencies used to do. And that's also a lot, producing the policies in CFSP. But even in these early days, it's doing them better, because we now have continuity, coherence from 6 months to 6 months, and between the Commission and the High Representative. That's a bit dubious sometimes these days, but at least in principle. And I think if you took that line, you'd be a lot more credible.
I think you should answer that one straight away, please.
Mm-hmm. Well, you're a much more experienced diplomat than I am, Brian, so I'm grateful for your advice. As I said before, I personally don't have much of a comparison to go on. I wasn't around doing this business when Javier Solana was. I was in NATO when he was Secretary General, but not when he. I wasn't in direct contact with his work since then. I did say that it is only just being set up. The Commission, the work the Commission delegations did, is indeed extremely important, and still is. And the example I gave on China is highly relevant to that. I think on the question of what successive presidencies did, but the EAS doing it better because there's continuity and coherence. You have to exaggerate a bit. I think that in a sense, but others who have more expertise may differ from me on this. In a sense, is yes, continuity and coherence, but maybe the kind of the political impulse of having every 6 months a new member state with its pet projects. That's not great for continuity, maybe, but it does, you get a renewed political impulse every 6 months, which is not in itself a bad, contribution to the EU's external policy. And so, in a sense, maybe the debate is around how that political impulse emerges on different areas of policy. And where that comes from, and Has that been fully resolved, and are the different institutions and the different member states allowing the space to do that, or are they encouraging it, and so on? I think that might be an area, an interesting area to discuss. But yes, I mean, is the present setup better or the same as the previous setup with the different presidencies? Again, it's perhaps, as someone said about the French Revolution, too early to say.
Thank you. I think we'll take three together now. One, two, three. Mm-hmm. You could stop there. Mm-hmm.
Thank you very much. John Preston, European Movement. Qualifications of diplomatic experience, none. Which leads me on to what I want to say about the late Professor Ralph Dahrendorf, who had a phrase which was, their strength lies in their weakness, and their weakness lies in their strengths. And I think if you're comparing the EEAS at the union level with the national components, you'll see that the EEAS has a lot of weaknesses, but it could play as strengths, because it isn't backed up by an army, and it isn't backed up by a past which, to some extent, preconditions how it might operate. So is there a role on the modesty side where the EEAS could complement that which would be done by the foreign offices of the nation states? And it could, for instance, open up a lot more talks, and maybe it already does, with Russia. And although the EEAS may have done a very good job in putting together sanctions against Iran, might that not be counterproductive to its role, where it could do an awful lot of work behind the scenes in trying to overcome the way Iran is behaving in the global forum?
Robert Brinkley, former British diplomat. I also want to ask about Russia, and inevitably at this conference there's been a lot of talk about process and generalities, but take the concrete case of Russia, and this is Europe's neighbourhood large power, very extensive in territory, in people, trade relations. I think Russia imports something like 53% of its imports from the European Union. European Union heavily dependent on Russia for energy supplies. But the European Union is far more developed and richer, so one would think that we ought to be able to influence policy in Russia rather better than we have. In fact, what has happened is that Putin's Russia has successfully been able to divide and rule. The European Union has not had a coherent or coordinated policy towards Russia. Now, do you believe that the EEAS will be able to improve that situation? And if so, when?
Thank you. I heard some music in my ears before. Strategic priority setting. It was something we discussed yesterday morning in another setting. I think the chair is absolutely right that the question of priority setting is a wider problem. I will come back to it this afternoon. I studied another organization, the OSCE, and I found out that they were working with 100 different organizations. And sort of there was a premium of just seeing yet another head of an organization and have yet another meeting and have yet another thing to discuss. To cut down the priorities and to develop measurements of success for just a very few priorities is a very difficult thing to do in an organization. So when you talk about priorities for strategic partners, for instance, then you are talking about something which I suppose would require something that the heads of state and government would have to take a position on. So what I'm referring to here is the need of having a review of the strategic priorities for the EU in external action during next year. And I just want to hear Hugo's view on the need for that, because that's a debate that is now coming up in parallel to the review of the External Action Service as such. Thank you.
Okay, there's no direct question to me, but I'll just make two points. I think the first is that there is a degree of cooperation, and I think, you know, we've had one of the member states which is most skeptical towards the European project as a whole, who's actually praising some of the work done by the External Action Service. I think the trick here is to what extent there are available incentives to increase that cooperation. Iran is, in many ways, is a good example, but it's something that can be done within or outside the EU framework. So what kind of cooperation are we talking about, and what can we expect? What spillover consequences may this have on other policy areas, other areas for cooperation, and so on? So I think the key is, the trick for the External Action Service would be to create those incentives to increase the level of cooperation, the scope of cooperation, the depth of cooperation. The second point, I think what is intriguing about the whole European project is that because you still have a foreign policy which is intergovernmental, you can, and the EU sometimes uses this sort of constructive ambiguity. Sometimes it uses it a bit too much and it becomes bankrupt, but you can use different hats and play around with things. The EU can engage with non-state actors, for instance, perhaps more easily than other actors, state actors can. But at the same time, it's composed of states, so it can also do the business of states. So there is some flexibility there if there were perhaps a greater unanimity. I mean, there was this in the whole period in which the External Action Service was created, there was so much talk in Brussels about singing from the same hymn sheet, even if not with a single voice and so on. That is actually quite important, precisely because if you have that, then you can be a more flexible actor.
Thank you. Here you go.
Thanks for those questions. I mean, strengths and weaknesses. Weaknesses are strengths. The EAS's modesty, perhaps being complementary to presumably the immodesty of the diplomatic services of member states. I think there's truth in that, and I think that is, you know, one of the ways EAS can add value, in the sense that, as I said before, if you have the EAS or EU delegations overseas explaining the policy on Iran, that carries less baggage than, for example, if a British diplomat is trying to explain our policy on Iran in certain parts of the world, that creates certain echoes that are not necessarily helpful to getting the message across. At the same time, I think one has to be careful about imagining that the EAS can deviate that far from the policies of member states in something which is so immensely difficult and delicate as the Iranian situation. And whilst the EAS should be able to work behind the scenes when that advances the situation, I don't imagine a situation where it could do that without at least a tacit approval of member states. And indeed, their credibility would depend on that to a degree. But I think, and I'm sure Robert Cooper said this yesterday, but I've certainly heard others say it, that there is nonetheless a little bit of wriggle room as between the EAS and the member states, which where, you know, they can be a bit more forward-leaning. For example, they were early on in the Syrian crisis in talking to opposition members, for example. There is a bit of wriggle room which allows them, I think, to kind of build on the difference, if you like, with where member states are. But I think there are limits to that. The point about Russia, I mean, I'm no Russia expert, but I agree that, you know, this question of priority setting is crucial to our success in being able to use the EU's collective weight in engaging with major powers. And I gave the example of China, but I think it's true of Russia too. I think ultimately the decisions of prioritization in such important relationships will, as you say, come down to heads of state and government. And it's not easy for heads of state or government to go home after a European Council and say, you know, well, their priority was considered important, but not as important as the top five on our list that we agreed. But that is always going to be an issue, and in a way, that's the kind of friction between having an EU policy and pursuing national policies. But, you know, I think we've done it before. I guess what one needs is for a critical mass of member states to accept that, you know, we have to move beyond an accumulation of national objectives and in a sense, leverage the EU as a whole to advance EU objectives. Not easy, and you know, member states will always want to have a hold on that. But I think more can be done, and we have proposed it actually on China. We've circulated a paper with some other member states on how we think we could do that. Was there anything else? Incentives to increase cooperation. I mean, I think I'll just come back to one point, which was your point, I think, that we shouldn't, perhaps on one level at any rate, we shouldn't see the way member states work with the EAS as so revolutionary or potentially revolutionary, because the international system is so complex now that we are constantly playing or working on a whole range of different levels, and managing the articulation between them is one of the ways you are successful or not. Thanks.
Thank you so much. We have 4 minutes, and we have 1, 2, 3 questions that we could take. Well, four. I can't refuse David. He's our you laid it on, so yeah. I suppose
I
can't.
I wish more people in my life had said that to me.
Well, okay. Yes, why don't you start? And we have one sentence question for each of the people who've asked for the floor. Yes?
I'd like to hear what the UK line is on the foreign minister's report recently, which the UK didn't join, the Vestavella report. Just simply, what does the UK think of it? Is there a line? And maybe what do you personally think of it? And you can go on Chatham House Rules if you want to for that answer.
All right. My question is more about the existential challenge that the EAS might represent for the FCO or other foreign ministries. I mean, of course, it's right, as Ivar says, that there is proliferation of diplomatic actorness. But then there's also a symbolic institutionalized sphere of diplomacy, which has to do with the Vienna Convention and all kinds of other entitlements that foreign ministries share as a group. Now, there was a speech last year by William Hague. It's called The FCO as an Institution. And in that speech, he laments the falling apart of the FCO, the falling apart, the undermining of its institutional memory. And the example of that would be the library in the ministry, which was given away to the University of London. And the only thing left was an old stuffed snake, which was given to the English king in the 19th century. And in a sort of in a passerby note in the speech, he says, "We will never outsource the representation of British interests to anyone, be that the EAS or anyone else." So I wonder what would be your position on that, Mr. Shorter?
Thank you. I'd love to hear more on what you said on ensuring consistency in EU external action, and specifically this integration between the Commission and the EAS. What is the line of the UK on that? And the reason I'm asking is this, because the picture that you painted of sanctions is fairly rosy, but it's not as much, not really to my knowledge, exactly like that. To give you a very concrete recent example, with Iran, the EAS wanted to impose sanctions on gas exports of Iran. So they wanted to strengthen it, not just oil and finance, but gas. And so they went ahead with the policy-making process, etc. And at some point, British Petroleum and Total, they go to DG Energy and say, but this actually blocks our export from Shah Deniz from Azerbaijan to Europe. So you're hurting EU energy security. You're hurting our commercial interests. And why did that happen? Because the EAS didn't actually consult DG Energy and the Commission on how to draft a sanction on all the technical details of gas markets, gas pipelines. So there was no culture, and there have been other examples like this in energies, no culture of consultation and Commission saying, guys, you simply don't know what you're doing. You don't have the expertise in energy. Ask us. And this didn't happen. And this happened several times. For example, they missed that Greece is purely dependent on Iran back earlier this year. So they missed that Greece couldn't go out and lend for oil anywhere else. So there is no culture of cooperation. So how would you see that, especially in the line of the review coming up next year?
And lastly.
This is a follow-up on the last question and on Russia. Has AEEAS been actually given a role to sort out conflicting foreign policies between member states?
Thank you. On the Westervelle report, let's be clear, first of all, that the signatories of that report didn't all agree with everything that was in it. For example, we know very well that a number of the signatories don't agree with the idea of a European army, for example. I don't think there are many areas in that report with which the Foreign Secretary would agree wholeheartedly. He would agree that there is more further to go in terms of making the EEAS a fully effective organization and in ensuring stronger cooperation between the EEAS and the Commission. He would agree with that. He certainly has a strong sympathy with the point around the democratic deficit in the EU. He might not propose the same solution to that problem as others. He feels that the way to address the democratic deficit is through the role of national parliaments. But he agrees that there is a problem there. He and the government strongly disagrees with the prospect of a European army or that the idea that decisions of war and peace could be taken by QMV. He thinks back to recent examples where the EU was divided on such issues, and it's inconceivable that either those who supported action in Libya would have been stopped because QMV meant that there was a decision against, or that those who opposed would have been forced to participate or support because QMV went against them. Those are decisions which are ultimately sovereign national decisions, and they will continue to be so as far as the UK is concerned. The threat to the FCO, what's the name of the snake? We've got in trouble. Albert? Albert, yes.
Albert the anaconda?
Yes. He's a very popular member of our service. I don't think anyone was suggesting that those things that that happened in the FCO over recent years were anything to do with the European Union. there were decisions, management decisions, about how to use inevitably limited resources, which involved, decisions about the library and the language centre and so on, which the Foreign Secretary disagreed. I don't think he'll be the last Foreign Secretary to disagree with some of the decisions his predecessors took. Never outsource representation of British interests. well, I can't improve on my own foreign secretary's comments. I mean, that's what he says. It doesn't mean that representation of British interests is never done through other parties. There are all sorts of ways in which we work with others to advance British interests, but I guess outsourcing is the key word here. And I think, you know, we feel the current situation in the EU, for example, doesn't represent outsourcing of representation of British interests. Commission EAS, well, I mean, I think that proves the point that I've been making, that the coordination and cooperation between those two key institutions, the Commission and the EAS, or institution and service, maybe is the correct term, needs to improve. I mean, it has to improve, and we will get a better product as a result if we can make that work. I mean, we are a bit sorry to see that the joint communication between the Commission and the EAS has been delayed. We'd expected it out around now. It's been pushed into next year, which is highly relevant to the EAS review. We do hope that these things will be sorted out. And then what else? Have I missed anything? Anyone feeling I've missed anything?
Thank you.
Yeah, 2 points. The energy issue, cooperation between, I think the energy has been particularly difficult, actually. I think they are, I mean, if I haven't done a sort of assessment across all policy areas, but my impression is that energy cooperation between DG Energy and the External Action Service has been particularly difficult right from the beginning. And there can be lots of reasons for this, but I think certainly it's a mutual thing. It's not just the External Action Service not consulting DG Energy. In other areas, I think there is better cooperation. For instance, the response to the Arab Spring, the three M's, mobility, market access, and more money, more mobility and market access, that required cooperation with different DGs in the Commission, and the Commission actually made an effort to make sure that all the meetings where, you know, the implementation of this strategy was to be decided, that there would be people there. So I think that's one example where there has been, where an effort, a greater effort has been made. But I think it has to be said that when the External Action Service started, at the beginning, relations between the External Action Service and the Commission were pretty poor. So the starting point was rather negative. On the External Action Service's role in solving divisions amongst member states, I don't see a huge difference. I mean, I think the big divisive issues that were there before the Lisbon Treaty are still there, and Russia is one of them. But at the same time, perhaps it's not the External Action Service we should look at to solve these differences. Of course, the High Representative now chairs the Foreign Affairs Council, so the sort of clearinghouse for these divisions still is now under the hat of the person responsible for the External Action Service, but this is exquisitely political, and in many cases existential. I mean, I mentioned Russia, one of the big dividing issues, and it will remain so. Another one, for instance, is Israel, and that's an existential division because member states have very different histories, shall we say, and that has a clear consequence on the policy choices and on the room for manoeuvre for the External Action Service. So I don't think it's probably a false expectation to think that the External Action Service is going to change this. What the External Action Service can do is improve joined-up policy making and create an innovative and new diplomatic class, shall we say, where problems perhaps are addressed differently. And with time, that may lead to different patterns of cooperation between the member states.
Thank you so much. We will reconvene here at 10:40, and I hope you will join me in thanking the speakers.